KALW.
Folks are in crisis, and so they're not thinking about, you know, November. They're thinking about today.
Californians without homes have the right to vote, but that doesn't mean it's easy.
I know it's important to vote. Like, I can't think about voting when I'm thinking about where am I going to move my stuff to, you know what I'm saying?
We'll hear from unhoused people in the East Bay on their role in today's presidential race. Then we'll meet a photographer who documents the lives that are swept up when an encampment is cleared.
It's not a one-size-fits-all. These are human beings.
And we'll hear about the exponential challenges people face when they're constantly being pushed along.
The homeless community takes better care of each other than a lot of the programs that are funded for that, it seems.
That's coming up. I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. It has arrived. Today is Election Day. By now, most of us have mailed in our ballots or are on the way to drop them off at a ballot box. But what if you don't have a physical address? Unhoused Californians have the right to vote, but many of them don't make it to the polls. Reporter Alastair Boone went to homeless encampments in the East Bay to talk to people about what prevents them from casting their ballots.
Hey. How you doing?
It's just a few weeks before Election Day, in the middle of a heat wave, and I'm on foot, looking for people to talk to. I come to these encampments a lot, but today I'm here to conduct a survey. My goal is to talk to 100 people about whether they plan to vote for president this year, and if so, for who. I meet lots of fierce guard dogs.
This is Bella.
Hi, Bella.
Oh, yeah, I guess you never got to meet Bella.
No.
It's Hi. Bella. Bella.
It's okay.
And I'm invited into all kinds of dwellings to talk to people.
Do you mind if I step on some stuff? Okay. It's like a mountain of suitcases.
Many people are more focused on staying hydrated and surviving the heat wave than their voting plans.
Oh, I ain't in a place to ask a question right now. I'm in too much pain.
But there are also lots of people who are excited to talk to me, and I get all kinds of responses.
I like having rights as a woman to choose.
Trump, 2004, and Biden no more.
I know it's important to vote. Like, I can't think about voting when I'm thinking about where am I going to move my stuff to, you know what I'm saying?
I did a similar survey in 2020. Back then, more people said they'd be voting for Biden than Trump, but more than half said they wouldn't be voting at all or weren't eligible to vote. I want to see what people are thinking about this now, 4 years later. This year, 27 people tell me they plan to cast a vote for Vice President Kamala Harris because they prefer her policy positions or because her campaign gives them hope.
You like the idea of a woman as president?
Yes, I definitely love it. I love it so much that I'm going to get other people to go vote for her too.
Really?
Hell yeah.
This is Tiffany in Berkeley. We're only using first names to protect people living in precarious situations. Dion is also voting for Harris. He feels it's his responsibility to support a black candidate from Oakland.
Yes, I plan on voting, casting my ballot. If you think about it, I'm an African-American, and we didn't really have a choice as far as casting the ballot.
Meanwhile, 10 people say they plan to vote for former President Donald Trump.
And what about you? Are you planning on voting?
Yes, ma'am.
Who are you going to vote for?
Trump.
These voters fall into a few categories. Some people say they like his untraditional campaign, like Jeremy in Berkeley.
He wasn't bred to be a president. He became one.
Some mention that no other president has ever sent them a stimulus check, like Trump did at the beginning of the pandemic. Others say they feel they can trust him because of how blunt he is. That's how Ray in Berkeley feels.
I don't know. He's more down to earth, but he's just an all-around good guy in my book. I don't think that he lost the first election. I think it was some flim-flam going on.
When it comes to misinformation like this, that Trump didn't actually lose the 2020 election, the unhoused voters I talked to mentioned some of the same ideas that millions of Americans believe.
First of all, misinformation is something that is not just in the unhoused community. I think the majority of folks in America have experience with this. I think many of us have relatives who we wish would be listening to different news sources than they are.
This is Bridget Nicoletti. She's an attorney at the East Bay Community Law Center who specifically works on homelessness. Bridget says many of her clients have a hard time finding reliable information about the election because they don't have a phone or regular internet access. But Bridget also says it's not just about misinformation. People also don't necessarily know they can vote. Homeless Californians gained the right to vote in 1985. If you don't have a fixed address, you can list a place like a public park, an intersection, or a shelter address on your registration form. And you don't need a state-issued ID to register or to vote. If you don't have one, you can go to the polls with any ID that has a photo of you on it, even an EBT card. But many unhoused people aren't aware of this.
Even though it's much easier to vote in California than many people think, like, it's the "than many people think" part that's the problem, right? Because people aren't aware that it's possible for them to go out and vote, and so they just don't do it.
But more often, she says for her clients, a lot of apathy about the election is rooted in the daily struggle to meet their most basic needs.
Folks are in crisis, and so they're not thinking about, you know, November. They're thinking about today, and folks are being swept from one location to the next, facing criminalization. I've seen them lose everything, you know, at these sweeps.
Lots of unhoused people are being displaced during encampment sweeps right now. In June, the Supreme Court ruled that cities can, in fact, shut down encampments even when there is no alternative shelter for their residents. Then in July, California Governor Gavin Newsom instructed cities to begin clearing out encampments or risk losing state funding. A lot of people at the encampments brought this up. Here's Bobby in Berkeley.
Our governor made a law, being homeless is legal.
That's illegal or legal?
Illegal. And that's wrong. How are you going to do that to people?
Of the 100 people I talked to, 49 say they won't vote, despite being eligible. This mirrors the national research. According to the very limited available data on this subject, 60% of Americans experiencing homelessness are eligible to vote, but only 10% make it to the polls. A lot of people tell me this is because they just don't trust the political system. Here's Jake in Berkeley.
I think it's all rigged, you know, that kind of thing, you know. Yeah. So I figure it doesn't even matter. They're going to put whoever they want in.
Many people say this, that the system just exists to empower the powerful and keep marginalized people at the margins. For the folks I talked to in the East Bay, this belief comes from feeling like their voices don't matter. Here's Jerry in Oakland.
Either one, it'll be the same way for us.
For who?
For homeless people. Either one.
And why is it going to be the same either way?
It never changes.
I hear this over and over. I know this system won't help me. It has never helped me before. Why should I participate? In Oakland, I'm Alistair Boone for Cross Currents.
Alistair covers homelessness for KALW. She's also director of Street Spirit, an East Bay publication written by and for unhoused people. A version of that story was published in Street Spirit's November issue, which is out now. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Back in July, the Supreme Court's ruling on Grants Pass versus Johnson essentially made it illegal for people to sleep outside in public places. People can be arrested and fined, and it's a lot easier for officials to forcibly remove unhoused people by sweeping encampments. In San Francisco, the sweeps have affected over 1,000 unhoused people, including those living in mobile homes and trailers. Pablo Anzueta is a photographer with El Tecolote, and he's been chronicling the challenges faced by the unhoused. KALW News editor Sunni Khalid spoke to Pablo about his work, what he's witnessed, and how people feel when their belongings are stripped from them.
What was it like for you to meet these people in their most desperate hour?
When I arrived there, the DPW had just left, and I get there and the wife, she's kind of distraught. She's kind of guarding what she has left. And also her neighbor who had just left the encampment, they took some of her belongings. So basically she got together the sleeping bags, put all these things in a cart, you know, really tidy. And then she had her little senior dog. And then Justin came and he sat, I just remember he sat on the stool just with a blank face, a blank stare. And he was just staring like almost like a defeated type of posture. And I think it symbolized the issue, the stressors, the mental health component to being unhoused and then now having to navigate these sweeps. And according to Mr. Frank, they also took his medication. He had some medication inside his tent, and it was the tent that was bagged and tagged. And what I've learned throughout like my years photographing homelessness and listening to these stories is that it's not a one size fits all. These are human beings with their own intricate nuances in life and their own stories and different services that are needed. But, you know, when we have crackdowns on homelessness, right, every time it happens, usually around election day or election season, there seems to just be one way that the city operates. And I think that's highlighted some of the fallacies, even in the policies that go with this.
Now, you wrote, and I quote here, "What many residents see as eyesores on city streets are in reality the human fallout of soaring living costs and a housing crisis that shows no signs of abating. The aggressive sweeps and the city's forceful displacement of RVs have highlighted the vulnerability of people's belongings, essentials that provide a semblance of stability and comfort." I was especially struck by the photo portrait that you took of Mikhail Hudson, and explain to our listeners what happened to him and his belongings.
Oh, man. I mean, just to take it back a little bit, Mikhail was having back problems 4 years ago. He was married, had a wife, normal lives like us, right? And his prescription ended and he got into fentanyl. And from then on, it spiraled and he's on the street. And he wrote on his notebook that about his wife, he lost everything and everything was his wife, you know? And he described in the notebook, he wrote how she was beautiful, but not even this beautiful woman that he loved could save him from the street, you know, from his addiction with fentanyl. So I think there's also like a lot of intersectionalities that we see in these stories, right? These types of very personal, intimate stories. It's the intersectionalities of being homeless. And I think with the general rhetoric that's happening, it turns into like one, it's like the general public perception, the eyesore, right? And that's all the public sees, nothing further, right? So that's kind of our job as photographers is to kind of peel those layers back a little bit more, right? Having a clear intention when we go out. Like, first of all, I ask myself, why am I doing this? You know, how am I going to do this? It's been covered. How can I tell this story differently? And what better way to do it through a collaborative type of approach where the pen is the microphone, right? And the paper is the lyrics. And that's how I kind of viewed it, is giving people the microphone to say, even if it's a sentence or, you know, a paragraph, to say, talk a little bit about their situation and their belongings. Because really, that's part of human nature. I think our belongings, that's an element to it, is how we are attached to certain things, right? Like sentimental value, right? And another thing that was very distressing to listen was Mr. Hudson's mother and brother's cremated ashes were thrown away when he was at the food bank. So imagine you're trying to survive, right? And you leave for like an hour to go get food. You come back and your tent's gone. The food that you gathered is gone. And on top of that, your most prized sentimental items are also gone. Where are they? Where have they gone? And that's the problem, is that I don't think the city generally provides the accessibility for folks to get their belongings back, nor is there accessible information for folks. I mean, mind you, these folks are going through mental health issues, or a lot of these folks don't necessarily have the interpretation or enough to comprehend the information. It's, you know, posted on a pole and the city says, well, we did notify them. We did put brochures, but there's nothing that's like elaborative, or it lacks humanity, to put it more, you know, straightforward.
Pablo, you are a Chilean American and you're bilingual, but a lot of the people who are in the RV camps that have been moved from place to place are Spanish speaking and are not able to understand much English or express themselves. How much of a barrier is language in helping people navigate their way through this space?
You know, specifically when we were covering the RV community, a lot of these folks, they migrated from Latin America, right? And that migration pattern is tied to poverty, political turmoil. So for them, it's, you know, leaving everything behind to come to the US. And we found that these folks are working class folks. And coming into a new country, only speaking Spanish in the US, where then you're trying to get your work permit, you're trying to get your visa, there definitely is a discrepancy there with the language barrier of being able to comprehend like what resources are out there. But luckily, there are organizations that are making sure that they're bridging that language barrier, even with indigenous speaking folks from Latin America. That's also seems to be like a big problem, a huge language barrier there. But what we found too is that there are organizations that are working to help translate. Could there be more help? I mean, of course, but I think that's also made it quite difficult for folks to like navigate the system here, but they're doing it. I mean, they're working, they're sending money back home. And I think that's also the human element to it, is how stressful that is to be in this vulnerable situation, not really knowing the country, the city, and then not speaking the language. But there are folks that it shows like the resilience that these people have, you know?
That was Pablo Anzueta speaking with KALW News editor Sunni Khalid about his recent photo essay documenting the lives of unhoused individuals as they face sweeps from Bay Area cities. We wanted to hear more from the people who'd experienced these kinds of sweeps. 45-year-old Misty lives in an encampment in West Berkeley, and she's been living out of her car until the city had it impounded. For safety reasons, she didn't share her last name. Here's her story.
That was all I had left, you know, after all this crap that I went through with these people. And it was like, that was my house, that was my access to, you know, being self-sufficient, to generating income, to visiting my children, my family up north. I mean, that was my freedom. That was my, you know, sanctuary. It was a safe space, you know, where I could keep all the craziness out and, you know, feel secure. And so they red tagged me, and it was like 3 weeks before they actually towed me. And that was because, like, begging. And I mean, I feel like I still am in like a full anxiety attack, you know? It's a little bit better, but for like those weeks, I couldn't breathe, it felt like, you know? And I just remember the parking meter person too saying, my tires were flat and it'd been vandalized. And like an hour later, the meter maid shows up with a red tag, and I was like, man, it's Saturday, can't you come back on Monday and give me a break? Because, like, Saturday, there's no tire shops open. Like, I don't, you know, limited income. And can you give me a break? And he goes, this is your break, the 72 hours, and slapped the thing on there. And I was like, oh, come on. Like, look, I have a police report and everything. Someone did this to my vehicle. Like, it's not my fault. And nah, this is your break, he said. Well, it's really hard. It's hard to, get a job if you don't have a place to shower and dress and, you know, like rest and wake up with an alarm and, you know, or a phone for, you know, some of those things are a little easier accessible than it used to be, but still it's a very challenging. And out here, it's like you turn your back and your stuff is gone. The shelters, it's like, I don't think is necessarily better. Some of them maybe, but you know, recently my backpack was stolen, you know, and there's my ID. Here we go, back to ground one, you know. So now there's no transportation, no money, no ID. You know, I can't. It's just really difficult, and it's scary because you just, so many setbacks, and it's really hard to get ahead, you know. Once you're in that position, once you're like, you know, have not a lot of resources, then it's really hard to claw your way back up, you know, because there's a few of those things that people don't realize how much you need, like internet right now in this time. You know, 10 years ago, it wasn't so vital, but now, I mean, job interviews are online. Your every application online. If you don't have internet access, you're at a huge disadvantage, you know? I just think there should be, it shouldn't be a crime to be housing challenged. It shouldn't be a crime to be low income, and it should be more not like, it's demonized in a way, you know, like, oh, derelicts, and that's not the case. Like, there's a lot of people struggling with health and mental issues, or, you know, like, life situations. Like, bad things happen to good people, and it's not just scumbags who are out here robbing and stealing. It's like, honestly, the homeless community takes better care of each other than a lot of the programs that are funded for that, it seems. You know, the old guy that everybody thinks is a drunk would be the first one to give you a jacket if he notices that, like, you're on, you know, on the street, you know? Like, shoot, 20 years ago, San Francisco, my RV broke down, and I didn't have anything when they towed it. Nothing. And the shopping cart guy is like, oh, sweetie, you look cold. Jacket, you know? Hungry, here's a drink. So, I don't know. It's like, people need to connect more on a human level, I think, and not just be so quick to say, oh, it's just a bum or, you know, derelict reject or something who's, you know, can't function in society. And if there's more tools for that, then I think there'd be a lot more success rate.
That was Misty, who's unhoused and living in an encampment in West Berkeley. That interview was produced by Victor Tense. We'll have more of these conversations and some of Pablo Unzueta's work at klw.org/crosscurrents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Tiny Gray Garcia, a.k.a. Poverty Scala, is a formerly unhoused, incarcerated, revolutionary journalist and poet. Here she is reading her poem. This poem is in honor of homeless mothers.
This poem is in honor of homeless mothers and poor mothers, low-wage mothers and no-wage mothers, migrante mothers and welfare mothers, incarcerated mothers, and indigenous mothers. In other words, this poem is in honor of D.H. Est with C.P. Est with, and most of all, a system messed with mothers. This poem is in honor of all us poor women and men. Because yes, I said, man, don't sing me that song about gender again. Who fight and struggle and steal and beg in every crevice and corner to keep our kids in a bed, who dress and feed with tired hands, who answer cries over and over again, who deserve to be coddled and loved, fed and protected instead of criminalized, marginalized, and never respected, who can barely make it, but always do, and still raise all the world's people like me and you and you. Can I get a witness? Who can barely make it, but sometimes do, and still raise all the world's people, like me and you and you.
That was Tiny Gray Garcia, a.k.a. Poverty Scala, reading her poem, This Poem is in Honor of Homeless Mothers. That's part of our series, Bay Poets. You can find more work from the series at klw.org/baypoets. Cross Currents is off tomorrow, but tune in at 11 for live post-election coverage. I'll be joining Rose Aguilar on Your Call for special coverage, so join us. That's tomorrow morning at 11 a.m. And join us tonight. Rose and I will be hosting live election coverage together at 111 Minna Street in San Francisco from 6 to 10 p.m. We'll hear from a whole slate of reporters and correspondents with live updates on the local races and ballot measures that matter most to you. So tune in to 91.7 FM or go to klw.org to listen live or come join us in person. And before we go, here's something not election related. Let's hear some music from a Bay Area band. This is the band Bobbing from the East Bay. They're playing Thursday night at 924 Gilman in Berkeley. Today's Cross Currents team includes Ganadi Joe Johnson, Troop Nguyen, Molly Blair Salier, Shirin Adil, Anisha Herjani, Marissa Ortega Welch, Angela Johnston, Lisa Morehouse, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.